Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for January the 14th, 2019. This is David Corey along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Hello, Richard.
Hey there, David, and good evening, everybody. It's great to be back on the air. Glad that BBS Radio has gotten through all their troubles and are back up and running and giving us some Veterans News Hour. But before jumping into our show tonight, I would like to acknowledge two sponsors of our show, Joyce and Joe Chivaroli, whose financial contribution helps us provide this weekly show for the benefit of veterans and their families across the country. Tonight we have a special guest, Mike Partain, who's been on our show previously. We're going to continue to discuss the issue regarding the toxic water contamination at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Of course, those of you who are familiar with it, it occurred between 1953 and 1987. But first, I'm going to remind everyone that this is a call-in show that welcomes your views, your comments, and your questions. So call us at any time during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free call-in number is 1-888-627-6008. And if you are a United States Marine who did serve at Camp Lejeune, you're going to find this show to be particularly informative and helpful. So if you have any issues, please reach out to us and call us at 1-888-627-6008. Mike Partain is a co-founder and public spokesman for an organization called The Few, The Proud, The Forgotten. From 1953 until 1987, the base water supply from Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, was highly contaminated with industrial chemicals. For the past decade, he has served as a community representative to the estimated 1 million sailors, Marines, and their families potentially affected by the Camp Lejeune contamination. He has testified before Congress, and he was invited as a special guest to the White House in 2012 for the signing of the Janie Ensminger Act into law. Much of his group's fight for justice was chronicled in the award-winning documentary Semper Fi, Always Faithful. And so without further ado, let's welcome Mike Partain to the Veterans News Hour. How you doing tonight, Mike?
Oh, I guess all right. I'm unfortunately a little under the weather this evening, but otherwise I'm here.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. You know, we're kicking off 2019 in a big way here, and one of those is to get right back into the Camp Lejeune water contamination issue. I know you and I have you know, we talk quite frequently, and there's some new developments. Before we get there, you know, briefly tell our audience, you know, what got you involved in the Camp Lejeune water contamination issue.
Well, you mentioned earlier that the water could possibly affect people's health. In 2007, I was diagnosed with male breast cancer, which is extremely rare in men, especially young men. I was 39. Years of age when I was diagnosed, and I didn't really have any of the risk factors. I don't drink, don't smoke, and there's no history of breast cancer in my family, male or female. And the only confounding factor was the fact that I was born aboard the base during the contamination period in 1968, and like I said, diagnosed at the age of 39. The chemicals that we are talking about tonight are the four main chemicals are trichloroethylene, which is a industrial solvent, tetrachloroethylene, otherwise known as PERC, which is a dry cleaning solvent. Then we have vinyl chloride, which is a degradation product of these two products, and then also benzene. Of the four chemicals, three are known human carcinogens. The fourth one is a probable human carcinogen, which is the dry cleaning product tetrachloroethylene.
Now, kind of tell our audience a little bit about, you know, how did the contamination start. I mean, you know, it's they built this base, and then, you know, how did it all come about?
Well, we don't have an exact date as far as when the contamination started. The dates that are given by the ATSDR, which stands for the Agency of Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, is a date from which they estimate by water modeling that these chemicals started to exceed what they call the maximum containment level, or MCL. That date is 1953. Now, the base was actually constructed in 1942, and there are indications that the, you know, contamination may have been earlier, but like I said, the MCL wasn't exceeded until 1953. Now, the sources for the contamination are multiple. Popular perception for a long time was that an off-base dry cleaner called ABC One-Hour Cleaners, located across the street from the housing area known as Terra Terrace, was the source of the contamination. And that is partially true. The ABC One-Hour Cleaners was using tetrachloroethylene in their operations, and they were disposing of the solvent in their drains and also using it as fill in their parking lot. Located down gradient from this dry cleaner was the family housing area, like I said, known as Terra Terrace. And this family housing area had its own water treatment plant that was pulling water from the wells located along Lejeune Boulevard. That's one source. And like I said, up until recently and even today, that was perceived to be the major contaminator for the base. In actuality, the major contaminant or contaminator on the base was the actual Marine Corps itself. Located across the New River is the main part of the facility known as Mainside. And aboard the Mainside area, you had a particular area called the industrial area, or had not born industrial area. And they were using the same chemical, tetrachloroethylene. They were also using trichloroethylene. And then the base fuel depot was located along Michael Street. And that fuel depot, it was about 900,000 gallon capacity, was leaking fuel into the ground. Matter of fact, when they finally started studying the fuel, the amount of the fuel leakage in 1988, 35 years after the contamination started, they found that the fuel levels were 15, I'm sorry, there was a layer of pure product 15 feet thick into the groundwater. And, of course, the areas around this, Hadnut Point Industrial Area, also had potable water wells that serviced the Hadnut Point water system. And this area was the worst of the contamination. To give you an example, in 1985, we have a reading in the potable water on the Hadnut Point system of over 1,050 parts per billion of trichloroethylene. Now, the readings over on Terra Terrace, to give you a comparison, were at tetrachloroethylene, which is it's a step up from trichloroethylene. Those readings were around 300 parts per billion. I don't remember the exact number. But to give you an idea, the containment level today is considered safe is 5 parts per billion. Wow. So this contamination existed you know, at different levels and various intensities from 1953 until they finally shut the water supply. Shut the contaminated wells down and stopped the exposures sometime in 1987.
Now, I know throughout the course of my representation of some of Camp Lejeune's veterans, they talk about, like, where did you serve on the base? And that tends to be somewhat of an issue. You know, they'll come to me and say, well, I served over here and I was working in that area. Tell our audience a little bit about how widespread that it may have been on Camp Lejeune.
Well, for purposes of the legislation that was passed in 2012 and also the presumptive service connection that was established in 2017, When you say Camp Lejeune, you are talking the entire installation. So if you're a veteran who served on New River, the air station, or on French Creek, or lived in Tarawa Terrace, or was on Hadnap Point, that's all considered Camp Lejeune for purposes of the presumptive service and the 2012 healthcare law. And what that means is if you come down with one of the conditions, like leukemia, and you were aboard the base between 1953 and 1987, then the presumptive is that you were exposed. Now, in actuality, what happens is when you're aboard Camp Lejeune, like, for example, my father, we lived in Tarawa Terrace, and he worked on Mainside, 8th Marines, and we were exposed because, well, I was born in the Naval Hospital, which was contaminated with Hadnap Point water. All my mom's prenatal visits were there, plus the officers' club, all the PX, the movie theaters, some of the restaurants were all on Hadnap Point, which is on Hadnap Point water, which is the worst contaminated water on the base. Even the rifle range had problems with their system. So, you know, depending where you're at, what you did on the base, you were exposed to different levels and different intensities. And that is why the law doesn't really stipulate that only the Marines who lived in Tarawa Terrace or who were barracked at Hadnap Point are covered by the law. So I don't know if that makes sense, but that's, you know, that's how it works. A lot of people still ask questions, well, you know, hey, I was at the air station. That is considered Camp Lejeune because that is part of the installation for purposes of the law. And by the way, New River did have their problems. We have no documentation of the solvents in the drinking water there, but the drinking water there had problems with what's called trihalomethanes, which is another volatile organic chemical that's a byproduct of chlorination. And because of the high salt content of the wells, those wells were producing waters that were not meeting the drinking water standards in the 1980s for TTHMs.
So we know that the period of time was from 1953 to 1987. When is it relatively certain that the military knew about the contamination? I know we shut them down in 87, but did they know prior to that and they just finally got around to do it in 87? Or did all of a sudden a light bulb go off and go, oh, we better shut this stuff down?
Well, that's been the big question and the subject of a congressional testimony, our hearing back in 2007 and 2010. The Marine Corps maintains that as soon as they knew that the wells were the source of contamination, they shut the wells down and supposedly stopped the exposure. That statement has mutated over the years. At first, they said back in the day, 1985, when this was, quote, discovered, they said that there was trace and minute levels of a unregulated compound in the water. They said they weren't violating any drinking water standards. Then it became any federal drinking water standards. Depending on what time you ask that question, you get different answers from the Marine Corps. Now, what we found through research, a good source of documentation and understanding for the Camp Lejeune drinking water contamination can be found on the website, The Few, The Proud, The Forgotten. On that website, there's a tab that says MCBCL timeline of events. And on that page, there is a timeline that is historically researched and linked to the Marine Corps documents. And when you review that timeline, one of the things that comes very evident is that in the early 1960s, the Navy had their own drinking water standards that was separate from the federal government or the public drinking water. They regulated their drinking water through what's called BUMED, the Bureau of Medicine and Surgery. And the BUMED Department of the Navy, division within the Navy, was responsible for maintaining drinking water standards aboard ships and aboard shore installations, including the Marine Corps facilities. And those, I apologize, my dog is now barking, but those regulations were, in fact, actually from 1962 until late 1988, which is ironic because the Navy actually withdrew the standards that was in place beginning in the 1960s and tied the Navy drinking water standards to the Safe Drinking Water Act, which was actually less restrictive than the Navy's own standards. By 1972, they were starting to look at trichloroethylene specifically in the drinking water. By 1974, we actually have a base order from the commanding general of Camp Lejeune identifying organic solvents, and that's what these things are, as hazardous materials, and that their improper disposal could lead to drinking water contamination. And then the first testing of the base water doesn't really start until 1980. And immediately when they did the first test, the base was warned and the Navy was warned that something was wrong with the water, yet no direct action was taken as far as turning off wells until November of 1984, November, December 1984, January through March of 1985. To date, the Navy has never really provided a decent explanation as to why it took them almost 4.5 years to shut the wells down once they knew that the wells were the source of contamination. Of course, the Navy has their own spin on that, but the documents don't lie.
Just amazing. And a lot of people have gotten sick, and a lot of people have died, and a lot of people are sick today, and a lot of people are dying today because of that contamination. You know, and your organization has been terrific in, being in the forefront and the proponent for all these Marines and sailors out there, helping them and shedding some light on this with Congress. And I know you've had your own battles. You've been on the front line. Tell us a little bit about how your organization began. I know your partner there, Jerry, the two of you stepped up, and unfortunately the loss of his daughter, but it's quite a story and quite a history. Share that story with us.
Sure. I mean, when you say partner, I'm more Jerry's partner than he is mine. Jerry is the point of the spear of this issue. Jerry's a retired master sergeant, 25 years with the Marine Corps. He spent two tours in the drill field. His little girl was conceived in the same neighborhood where I was born, about 7-8 years after I was born. She developed leukemia at a young age and then died in September 1985 of leukemia at the age of 9. He didn't really know about this, even though he was there at the base when it was going on. He retired from the Marine Corps in 1995. And shortly after he retired, he found out through a public service announcement and news story that the drinking water was contaminated, and they were actually looking at the children born at the base for studies. And as he said, he about dropped his plate of spaghetti on the floor because he realized that, you know, what they were looking at, which was they were looking at childhood leukemia, was directly connected to his daughter's death. That all started in 1997, 10 years before I was even diagnosed. And for 10 years, Jerry started fighting this, asking for information, demanding records. He took part in the formation of what's called the Community Assistance Panel, or CAP, which is a entity that works with ATSDR, the agency that studies Superfund sites such as Camp Lejeune. By the way, Camp Lejeune was designated as a Superfund site in October 1989, and is still somewhat almost 30 years after the base was declared a Superfund site. They're still trying to clean up the contamination aboard the base to give you an idea how bad it was.
Wow.
They don't expect to be completed as far as the remediation, I think, to around 2030 is what, and I'm not sure of that date. Anyways, Jerry, you know, was pushing this issue forward. There was others who were involved, like Major Tom Townsend. His little boy was actually conceived at Lejeune about the time that I was conceived. Or, I'm sorry, he was born at Lejeune about the time I was conceived and died shortly after birth of problems. And then the Byron family, who was there in the 80s, they had a child who was cleft palate, another child that developed a type of anemia, which is extremely rare. Not anemia, but I forgot the name of the illness, but it's extremely rare. And she is one of a handful of people that have this disease. It's called aplastic anemia. I just remembered the name. And of course, I became involved in 2007 after I was diagnosed with male breast cancer out of the blue. Coincidentally, since my diagnosis and involvement, we found about 116 men that share the single commonality of male breast cancer and exposure to the drinking water aboard the base. It's the single largest male breast cancer that's ever been identified. Unfortunately for us, one of the problems is it's so rare they really can't, they don't have a handle on the disease to determine the actual causation because it is extremely rare. We primarily fought this battle by, getting the word out. It took Jerry and an act of Congress, literally, to force the Marine Corps and the Department of the Navy to start notifying the families. That took place in 2007. There were a couple of hearings since then where Jerry's testified, I've testified about the facts about Camp Lejeune. And over the years, we've gotten the word out across the country. One of the things about Camp Lejeune that you have to understand is, I was born there. My birth certificate says Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, Onslow County. And, as a child, that was pretty cool because I could say, hey, I was born at a military base. But Camp Lejeune is not home for me. Camp Lejeune is where I was born. Home for me is Winter Haven, Florida. That's where my father, after he resigned his commission in the Marine Corps, where we moved to when I was 4 years old. And I up until 2009, I never set foot in the base, never saw the base, was never in that area again. So like many other families, Camp Lejeune is not a town. It's not a place where you can go see. Even if I wanted to, you have to get permission to get on the base. It's a Marine Corps installation. So when these families have children or live on the base or serve as a Marine or as a sailor on the base, they go home to their individual towns and they're scattered all over the country. Actually, they're scattered all over the world. We have Marines and sailors who are part of our group that are in different countries. So that's one of the hardest things that we've had to fight is the fact that we've been scattered and disorganized over the past 30 years all over the country. Now, with the legislation, the awareness that was the notifications that took place, that has activated the community. And perhaps the single most thing that's really energized the community was the fact that in 2017, we were able to secure the largest presumptive service connection since Agent Orange in Vietnam, which is the eight conditions that are currently recognized by the VA as a presumptive service connection due to the exposures at Camp Lejeune.
And that's a rebuttable presumption, though. I remember last summer on the show we talked about that, just like the Agent Orange. I got a couple of questions here. When you testified before Congress, I'm just curious, what was the feeling that you got, with the questioning from the different congressmen? I mean, were they open? I mean, were they aggressive? Were they friendly? I mean, Were they taking it seriously? It just seems like this thing has gone on for so long, and Congress, we're kind of relying upon Congress to do the right thing. What was your feeling in terms of the reception that you got?
Well, we've had support across the party lines for this issue, and we've had some problems with with both parties with this issue. When you asked about testifying, the hearing, I testified in two hearings, one in the Senate and one in the House. The hearing in the House that was probably the more memorable one, mainly because of one of the was the more memorable one because of one of the reactions from one of the committee members, and it was Representative Paul Brown, I think from North Georgia. I can't remember the town. It may be where University of Georgia is located. But anyways, he was openly sympathetic for the Marine Corps, and despite the fact that he was a medical doctor, seemed to shield or at least try to protect the Marine Corps more than he was asking questions. As a matter of fact, when after the hearing, the Marine Corps representative, General Payne, started to talk to me. You know, we've been adversaries because he was a public spokesman for the Marine Corps, but, you know, I respect the office and rank. And, you know, the man was, you know, doing his job, but at least he was civil about it. And we were having a polite conversation, and he was informing me that he was retiring from the Marine Corps, and we were just talking, and all of a sudden, Representative Brown stepped in between us and literally pushed his back against me to cut me off. I guess he thought that I was trying to confront or play some, do some showboating with the general. Anyways, that was very rude. The chairman of the hearing, Representative Stupak, which he's, I believe, since retired from Congress, he was asking questions and was duly outraged with the, especially the information that we presented in the hearing, you know, showing that the Marine Corps at one point knew about the contamination but failed to shut down the wells. Now, the problem we have with Congress is not necessarily the outrage, but the science. And what I mean by that is the contamination, you know, involved synthetic man-made chemicals. Some of these chemicals are over 100 years old. Like trichlorethane was actually invented in 1890 as an industrial solvent. The problem is there's really no science to show what these chemicals do to people because we don't experiment. You know, we're not Nazi Germany. We don't experiment on live people. So what you have to do is you have to kind of look behind the facts or behind the scenes after something's happened. And the problem with that is, you know, once we let these chemicals out in the environment, and you start looking at the telltale signs or effects of those chemicals upon a human population, and you start to see something bad, well, that creates a problem. The people who created those chemicals and the people who use those chemicals and dispose of them in the environment are now responsible for their actions. And you have to hold them accountable because, like in the case of me, you know, I got breast cancer. Well, they equally use science to try to block or at least mask any effects of these chemicals and try to obfuscate the truth of what's happening. So you have a battle between, you know, people who are exposed and people who are potentially liable for their misuse or misapplication of chemicals. And unfortunately, what happens is money gets involved. And the communities that where these chemicals appear are dumped into the environment, they don't have the resources to fight. You know, they're often fighting for their lives. Whereas, you know, the Marine Corps, Department of the Navy, or a corporation has lawyers at their disposal. They have lobbyists. They have money to be able to try to influence or at least direct science or create their own science, which is one of the things that we saw happening with Lejeune. To kind of circle back to what you're asking, what's changed over the years and got Congress more energized, especially to create the presumptive service connection 10 years after the initial hearing on Camp Lejeune, is that the science started coming around to show that these chemicals did indeed affect people's health. For example, in 2011, trichloroethylene was declared a human carcinogen by by the EPA, and had previously been declared a carcinogen by IARC, and I believe the National Toxicological Council is declaring it as declared a human carcinogen as well. You had health studies, some that were done at Camp Lejeune, that showed a link between exposure to the chemicals and adverse health effects. And that was the deciding factor that got Congress involved because, you know, anyone can claim, oh, hey, I drank this chemical and made me sick, but there's got to be science behind it to establish those claims and provide guidance for Congress to act. And once that science became known, than Congress took action in the form of getting presumptive service connection.
Can I ask a question here, Rick and Mike? Mike, this is David Corey. Thanks again for being on our show. Along the lines of what you were just saying about science and proving things, as you know, and as probably some of our listeners know, but maybe not all our listeners know, is that the Janie Ensminger Act, which provided veterans and their family members who are at Camp Lejeune, provides them with health care if they develop any one of 15 different conditions, which include things like bladder cancer, breast cancer, esophageal cancer, kidney cancer, leukemia, lung cancer. There's a long list. There's 15 that qualifies someone for health care for the treatment. But that was a law passed by Congress. But in the 2017 regulation, which was not passed by Congress, but which was enacted as a regulation by the VA, that the list was much shorter. The list was only 8 conditions, and breast cancer wasn't on them. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, like I mentioned, one of the things that with breast cancer, there is basically very little to no studies on male breast cancer and these chemicals. And with male breast cancer, I mean, there's just nothing there. And there's one study that was done by OTSR that suggested an early onset of male breast cancer in men after exposure to the chemicals. But the science isn't there yet, and that's one of the reasons why male breast cancer isn't on there. Female breast cancer is not on the list because there are equal studies that say that there is no effect, and there are studies that say there are an effect. So when the ATSDR went to provide the recommendations, it was inconclusive. So when we talk about, you know, Congress and the VA, understand the VA, yes, they are the ones that announced the presumptive service connection, but the reasons why they were put in the position to do so was because of the activities of the community, getting science involved, but more importantly, going to Congress, specifically Senator Tillis, out of North Carolina, and Senator Burr out of North Carolina, and to a degree Senator Nelson from Florida, putting pressure on the VA to act upon the science and what was known and publish the presumptive service connection. Does that make sense?
Well, it does, but I still am kind of mystified. And you may not have an answer to this. I would understand that, but is the fact that Congress passed a law in 2012, based on presumably a variety of influences, including the consideration of science, but probably also just political pressure and other reasons, that had the list of 15 for health care, but then the VA, and I understand your point about the VA doing it because of congressional interest, but ultimately, instead of Congress passing another statute to specifically list the conditions for disability compensation and the presumptions for disability compensation, they left that up to the they left that up to the VA to determine. And I understand that process. That's similar for the Agent Orange conditions. But my point is, it would appear to have been more beneficial to veterans and family members if Congress had just gone ahead and enacted a statute that included the same 15 in the longer list and perhaps some other ones that are on the shorter list but not on the longer list, and said those also apply for disability compensation purposes. So that's just...
Well, part of that problem has to do with the changes that took place in Congress between 2012 and the present. Some of that, and we actually had problems with getting the original bill passed for the same reasons. The mantra in Congress was, well, how are you going to pay for it? And we kept running into that over and over again. Matter of fact, the original 2012 law was pigeonholed in committee by then he's now gone, but the House Chairman for the Veterans Affairs Committee, Jeff Miller out of Pensacola, Florida. And right. It took Jerry and I embarrassing him and forcing it out of committee to be passed, because it had already been passed in the Senate. And finally, you know, he was opposing it because, you know, it was going to be new spending. And he had signed a pledge that there was going to be no new spending that he would approve, which was a bunch of bull crap. I mean, if you poison your veterans and their families, your first duty is to take care of them, not to some stupid pledge to spend money or not.
Right.
But there was a lot of behind-the-scenes political wrangling that went on during this time period. You know, I could spend several nights talking about it, but what people don't realize is that all these steps that took place and milestones took place by a lot of effort going to Congress and, you know, going, this was, Jerry would say, spending shoe letter, going up to Congress, meeting with congressional officials, representatives, senators, their staff, laying out what we have. And then also while we're doing that is getting the science involved, where, you know, when a scientific study would come in and we would take that study and say, here, this is what we're talking about. For example, when EPA declared trichloroethylene a human carcinogen, because once we had that, I mean, how can you deny the effects?
Right.
And that was the problem we were facing, was everyone was saying, well, so what, you were poisoned. You know, you can't prove that this harmed you. And probably one of the most damning scientific studies that came out, it wasn't really a study, it was just a review of literature, took place at the direction of the Department of the Navy through the National Academies of Science in 2009. It was a report that was actually commissioned by Congress, and then erroneously Congress allowed the Department of the Navy to write the directions for the report to the National Academies. And what ended up happening in 2009, this report came out and said, yes, you were exposed, yes, something should be done, but we can't prove anything happened as far as health effects, and you never will. And the Navy used that to try to shut everything down for Camp Lejeune, and it took Congress and science, actual scientific studies and media pressure to finally get the Navy off this report and allow things to move forward. I mean, I'm starting to get convoluted, because this is a very complicated issue that isn't explained easily by a few sentences or a few statements. I mean, it took a lot of effort. And, I mean, you're talking, listen, my involvement, 12 years from 2007 wow. to the present to get where we're at now. And Jerry's been at this for almost 22 years.
So, Mike, go ahead.
Mike, to where we are now, that's a good way to kind of segue into where are we now? You know, it's 2019. We had the bill in 2012 and then 2017, and here we are going in 2019. You know, where are we now? What can we tell our Marines and our sailors out there who are affected by Camp Lejeune, that there might be some hope?
Well, here's where we're at now. You know, we got the initial law 2012. We got the presumptive service connections in 2017. Now, there's two facets to this contamination. One is you have the service personnel, the Marines and the sailors, who were aboard the base that were exposed. Now, unlike Agent Orange in Vietnam, you've got the families. This is a domestic exposure, the largest domestic exposure of military personnel and their families that's occurred in this country. So, like I mentioned before, I was born on the base. My mother lived on the base. So you have families that are involved in this as well. And we were equally exposed, and sometimes even worse, because while my father, you know, went to Vietnam and, of course, was exposed to Agent Orange there, other veterans throughout the years went on floats, deployments, and what have you. Their families remained aboard the base. As one of the members of our community told me, he was a combat wounded Vietnam veteran, he goes, it's one thing to put me in harm's way and expose me to chemicals in the combat zone, but my family was supposed to be safe aboard the base. And to expose my family and my daughter, he said he could not ever forgive that. So with the families, the issue is this. In 2014, the government, and before I say this, let me preface this, the families aren't necessarily covered by the VA. So the 2017 presumptive service connection does not apply to the families. The only coverage we have is through the 2012 Janie Ensminger Act. It's a limited health care coverage that provides medical care as a last resort. So in other words, if my father comes down with kidney cancer, God forbid, he gets a presumptive service connection. He receives medical benefits. If he becomes disabled because of it, he receives disability benefits. And if he dies because of kidney cancer, then my mother would receive survivor benefits. Now, then that's because of the presumptive service connection. Now, my mother or myself, if we come down with kidney cancer, all we receive is limited medical health care as a last resort, meaning that my health insurance pays first, and there's no disability, there's no death benefits, there's nothing else. So there is a disparity between the service members and the families created by the presumptive service connection. Part of that disparity was made worse in 2014 by the Supreme Court. And what happened there is the families, in order for us to seek justice, we have to use the court system through the Federal Tort Claims Act. And the Federal Tort Claims Act, a lot of people often ask me, well, can we just do a class action against the government? Well, you can't. The Federal Tort Claims Act basically strictly limits when a citizen can sue their government. There's no class action. There's protections for the government, like sovereign immunity, meaning that the government did something because it's the government, and yes, you were hurt by it, too bad. The veterans are also subject to this, but because of the Ferris Doctrine, they're regulated to the VA, and that's where we end up with the presumptive service connections. Now, in 2014, the federal government actually approached a private polluter in Asheville, North Carolina, who was being sued for dumping trichloroethylene and poisoned families around their plant in Asheville. This corporation was called CTS Corporation, and they had a facility, and they were dumping trichloroethylene. And what happened was they were losing in federal court because they were trying to challenge the circular liability laws in court, and they lost. The Department of Justice, shortly after they signed the 2012 health care law for Camp Lejeune, I'm sorry, when I say they, the president signed it, the Department of Justice approached CTS Corporation's lawyers and asked them to push their case to the Supreme Court and then offered to write an amicus brief on behalf of CTS Corporation. This amicus brief was basically in support, and the government actually said this in the brief, that they wanted to support this to test basically a technicality, a get-out-of-jail-free card for their concerns at Camp Lejeune. And the long story short was the case was accepted by the Supreme Court, heard by the Supreme Court, and in a befuddling judgment kind of reversed some of the tenets of history, one of which was that federal law superseded state law, which we fought mm-hmm. a civil war over. And the court came back and said that the North Carolina statute of repose basically limited the ability of the families to claim injury because of their exposures at Camp Lejeune. Like in my case, because of the court ruling, I would have had to turn in a claim for a disease I did not have or know I had 12 years before I became diagnosed with male breast cancer, because the end date was 10 years after the last action, which the Navy and the Department of Justice contends was in 1995, 12 years before I was diagnosed. Now, with that being said, and to segue what's something new here, this ruling by the Supreme Court that was rendered in 2014 has basically blocked any type of remedy for the families for the past 5 years now. The Bell Legal Group out of South Carolina is working with Congress to come to basically introduce legislation that will hopefully overcome the Supreme Court hurdle and permit the federal tort claims to proceed. Because up until this technicality was put in place, the government was losing in the court. The other cases, one they had thrown out because they reopened a bankruptcy case for the plaintiffs, and use that bankruptcy case to throw their case out because they didn't list the fact that they were suing the government in their bankruptcy, which was caused by medical conditions from Camp Lejeune. The plaintiff had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And the government was losing up until they got this technicality from the Supreme Court. So in the next, hopefully this session in Congress, we're going to see the introduction of legislation that will permit the families and the service members to file under the Federal Tort Claims Act for their injuries at Camp Lejeune. And that's the big news that's come out or coming out this year.
So, Mike, if you were talking to some constituents out there, who would you tell them to, you know, send a letter to or try to get active and encourage Congress to take action?
Well, the big thing right now is we got to get the legislation introduced and the sponsor. Now, how this works is once we get the legislation introduced by a member of Congress in either the House or the Senate, then it's going to go through committees. And this is where our weakness actually becomes a strength. Once the legislation is announced, we'll get this on our Facebook page, which is the Camp Lejeune Toxic Water Survivors, and also the Few, the Proud, the Forgotten, both on Facebook and the Internet, the web. We'll make those announcements. And this is where it's critical that our community and other veterans, you don't necessarily have to be a veteran of Camp Lejeune. If you're listening here tonight and you're on an Army base or an Air Force base and you want to support your fellow Marines and their sailors, contact your representatives and your senators from your state and say, hey, I was aboard the base. I heard about this. I'm a veteran. I want you to co-sponsor this bill. I want you to support this bill. And that's how this gets moved along because, you know, like here in Florida, we've got 20,000 plus members and, you know, who are registered with the Marine Corps for the exposures at Camp Lejeune. If all 20,000 of those people were to call Senator Rubio, Senator Scott, and their representative and say, I want you to support this legislation when it's announced or, you know, at, you know, with the bill number once we announce it, I guarantee you that those three politicians are going to be on board supporting this bill through Congress. And if this happens in all 50 states, then I guarantee you this bill will pass, probably unanimously, because we have members in each state of this country.
Other than your Facebook pages, which I'm quite familiar with, is there anything else that our listeners can do to help your organization?
Well, if you were aboard Camp Lejeune during the contamination period and you felt that your health was affected, you can also contact the Bell Legal Group. They are maintaining a registry as far as keeping a record of the people who are, you know, potentially helped by this bill. So if you contact the Bell Legal Group, and I'll get you the number for that, that's probably the best thing to do, you know, to help get this thing moving forward.
Well, that sounds great. David, do you have anything further? Mike, this has been terrific. You've really given us a lot to chew on tonight.
Yeah, I want to say I want to echo those thoughts too, Mike. Thanks so much, and thanks for bringing us up to speed with that proposed legislation. I hope that there will be some sponsors on both the Senate and the House side, and we get some action soon in committees, then on to the passage by both houses. So good luck with that. We hope you'll be back on our show sometime to keep us updated on developments.
Yes, I will. And as soon as I hear anything about this legislation, I will let Rick know so you guys can talk about it and get the word out.
Great. We'll have you back on the show as this thing starts developing.
I'll be glad to join you. Hopefully, I got sick tonight at the last minute, and I've been struggling this past hour to keep
Well, thank you very much, and hope you feel better.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Hope you feel better.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Take care now.
You guys.
Well, that was great, David.
Yeah, it was, Rick. And I know we're down to our last 5 minutes. Thanks again to Mike Partain for his expertise and his insight. I just got one thing, Rick, before we go to our coaching into care.
Yeah, no, go ahead, David, please.
Yeah, it's an announcement that I made last week on the show, maybe of interest to some veterans and their families. And it's this, the 2019 National Veterans Wheelchair Games will be held in July, specifically July 11th through the 16th in Louisville, Kentucky. A week ago, registration opened for the 2019 National Veterans Wheelchair Games, and it'll continue. Registration will continue through April 15th. Anyone that may be interested can go to the website, wheelchairgames.org. Again, that's wheelchairgames.org. And as I say, last week the VA announced that veterans that are interested can start registering online. The sporting event is presented by both the VA and the group called Paralyzed Veterans of America. It's the world's largest sports event for veterans who use wheelchairs. It'll be held July 11th to 16th at the VA Medical Center in Louisville, Kentucky. So over to you, Rick.
Well, thank you, David. And before we do close the show tonight, we'd like to provide our weekly reminder to veterans and their families about an important VA program called Coaching Into Care. It helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching Into Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Give the program a call. The number is toll-free at 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Again, the VA's Coaching Into Care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I'd like to once again remind listeners that if you know a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has a Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line number is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Back to you, David.
Thanks, Richard. Well, it's time for us to go for this evening. We'd like to thank all of you for listening to the Veterans News Hour here on BBS Radio Station 1. I'd like to thank our special guest tonight, Mr. Mike Partain, from the organization called The Few, The Proud, The Forgotten, who shared his expertise about the issue of water contamination that occurred at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina between 1953 and 1987 and still affecting people today. We'd like to thank our sponsors, Joyce and Joe Chivaroli and Corey and Hurley Law Group, for making this show possible. And we'd also like to thank our producer, BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. We hope you'll all tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Until then, we hope you have a great week.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.